Welcome to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Sarah Martin in Adelaide. Today on The Wire...
There is a commitment now for both the Noongar and the state government to work towards building a framework to legislate treaty, hopefully within the next 2 to 3 years.
The Noongar Nation in South Australia takes its first step towards a treaty and...
Human trafficking is the greatest human rights violation in the world today, and even though abolitionist slavery over 200 years ago, there are more slaves today than there have ever been before.
You may not think Australia is a part of human slavery, but we are a key part of the demand problem. Also on the show, Billy Graham's legacy and data breaches. We have a look at new legislation. All of this coming up on The Wire. New legislation going into effect today will see businesses required to notify individuals of breaches of personal information. The scheme, which was approved last year, requires businesses and government agencies to report breaches of data that could cause serious harm to individuals. But what is serious harms, and who could be sharing your personal information? The Wire's Jessica Supple spoke to David Vale, Executive Director at Cyberspace Law and Policy Centre at the University of New South Wales.
The international description is mandatory data breach notification laws. So the mandatory means must tell. The data breach is personal information of yours that's held by someone else, whether it's typically business or government, and the notification is that some way or other they're supposed to actually let you know when they lose your stuff.
Personal information can be a very broad term, as David Vale explains.
It's information which identifies you directly, so obviously name and address, phone number, things like that, but also information from which you could be identified. So it could be your medical records, it could be your psychiatric history, it could be your credit history, maybe it's all of the logs of the sites that you've visited or something like that. And so over time, as big data proliferates, then more and more information can be traced back to you. And so as time goes on, what is legally considered personal information expands further and further.
Unlike other countries around the world, Australia has only just introduced this scheme. I asked David Vale what system we had in place in the past.
In the far past, there was no law on this in Australia. A few years ago, the Federal Privacy Commissioner put out a voluntary data breach notification scheme, which encouraged people to tell their data subjects or their customers if they'd lost their data. In one sense, it's better than nothing, but it had a sort of potential perverse disincentive. Because it wasn't illegal not to tell, and not many people did tell, the ones that did reveal and did notify sort of stuck out.
David Vale says this scheme still has a number of weaknesses.
It's not covering businesses that are turnover under $3 million. So a lot of small businesses can lose your data and they can say, oh, we don't have to tell you, and that'll be legally correct. There's also the problem that there's a sort of an inbuilt test of seriousness. So it's not every breach that's covered by this new law. The host has to decide that it's serious enough. And so they've got another disincentive here to sort of treat it very seriously. If they just say, oh, it's not really a problem, they can potentially get away with it. I suppose there's an even greater problem that they may just think of the broad mass of their customers. And by the way, we don't get a say. You know, the data subjects are not asked about whether it's serious enough, so they just make up their own mind on this. And there may be some people who are especially vulnerable. You know, there might be in a community group that's discriminated against, or someone with a bad mental health, or they're running away from someone violent, or they're sort of on the verge of bankruptcy or suicide, and the harm may be much more worse to them than it is the big bulk of the people affected. And it's not clear that the standard the data host has to follow is thinking about the vulnerable ones first. So, you know, there are some significant limitations there. Look, on the other hand, now I think it's going to be very clear that if you don't notify, that you're doing the wrong thing, that people will expect to be notified, and the reputation harm will start to be very serious for either people who don't notify at all or who delay. I suppose there's also another, I suppose, weakness in the scheme as far as I'm concerned about delay. You as a host who lost the data get up to 28 days to decide whether you have to notify people, basically. And so to me, that's completely wrong. We're living in an integrated internet world where data can cross the Pacific in 100 milliseconds. The idea that you can wait for a month before telling people, for instance, if you need to change all your passwords or if you need to check your credit card or maybe cancel your credit card or maybe you're at risk, you might need to think of trying to move house or something. You don't want to be doing that a month after the data was lost because it could be used or copied or distributed almost instantly. The presumption, I think, should be on nearly immediate notification, basically because that protects the interests of the data subject.
David Vale, Executive Director at the CyberSafe Law and Policy Centre at the University of New South Wales, speaking there with The Wire's Jessica Supple. In an Australian first, the Noongar Nation of the York Peninsula in South Australia and the South Australian Government have signed an agreement granting the traditional owners greater say in governance of their people. The Butuhira Agreement lays the foundation for a treaty, which could be in reality as little as 2 years from now. Gary Goldsmith is the chairperson of the Noongar Nation Aboriginal Corporation. He spoke to The Wire's Rachel McDonald on Kaurna Country about the agreement and the dreaming story of the Butuhira, which inspired it.
It's about a man that showed resilience, showed passion and pride for his country, and also protected his country as well. And the story goes about an intruder that entered the country, and Mother chased this man from his country and threw his what we call a wadi, his weapon, and that missed this intruder, who was scared off, in short, and the wadi broke into pieces, which now has some significant landmarks across Goorinda, York Peninsula, on our country. So the head of Mother Rock is located near Gugguthy, which is just outside of Port Victoria on York Peninsula. So you can see that it's a very enriched story, but at the same time, in meaning, it has good reference to the agreement because it sets the foundation for the Noongar nations to reach its aspirations as a nation, to provide opportunities to our people. It's not going to be the fix for all things we require, but it is definitely a start that puts us in the right direction, particularly when you want to be able to sit at the table with the government and not have to go through the bureaucracy, through the processes occupied by red tape, but also for us to build our capacity and other ways to become self-determined, so with business opportunity as well, whilst getting the support and resources from the state government.
Tell me a little bit about what it took to get this agreement through.
Yeah, it was a whirlwind process. Minister Maher, Aboriginal Affairs, announced that he would be entering into treaties with Aboriginal nations. There was an expression of interest which we applied as the Noongar Nations, and I guess we were successful in meeting the criteria for the expression of interest about being able to negotiate and prepared to negotiate with the state government in regards to working towards a treaty. Now, that was the intent from both parties, to work towards a treaty. And look, it's still on the table. When I say it's still on the table, there is a commitment now for both the Noongar and the state government to work towards building a framework to legislate treaty, hopefully within the next 2 to 3 years, and putting that towards cabinet for them to make the decision on. There was nothing that wasn't on the table, but there was, you know, some legalities and concerns around what was asked and what was being offered from both sides. It was clearly understood after the second and third negotiating meetings that we weren't going to reach a treaty within that time. Is it possible? Yes, definitely. We hope that would happen with the Butuhira Agreement. We would like to better build relationships, and this is what this agreement is about. As with the Butuhira Dreaming, it's a foundation to creating something that is going to be part of a bigger picture and a legacy that we would hope the state government and the Noongar people will be proud of.
What would a treaty at a state level and a local level and a national level mean to you?
It'll mean many things to me, but I think it mean many things not only to my people and other Aboriginal nations, but to the wider Australia. I think it's now starting to be put onto the table, and this conversation does get discussed about treaty and the historical foundations of this country, knowing that we do know that the country was not colonised, it was actually invaded, and our people were subjected to some horrendous treatment, not only in the early years of colonisation or invasion, but also throughout, you know, the remaining years up until now, including to the current treatment that we have for our First Nations peoples that still live on country and within communities, you know, that are being squeezed to move off their own land. it's the recognition of that we are the traditional owners of this country, and it's Aboriginal land always has and always will be, as the Minister puts it quite finely. But that needs to be recognised by the wider community. It needs to be acknowledged, and it needs to be taught within schools about the history of this country. It shouldn't be swept under the carpet to say that we as wider Australia helped the Aboriginal people to modernise their lives and live the way of the Western world, because it goes against the acknowledgement that there were really good systems in place, both law, relationships, country, economics, ecology. There were really good systems in place to take care of this country. And for somebody to come in and say that we know better without acknowledging that, that really ingrains why this treaty is so important. It really acknowledges that our systems and our beliefs and our traditions are just as important, if not more important, than the ones that were bestowed upon us. The treaty in a whole will open up a lot of doors. It may not please everybody, but at least it's a recognition of what actually happened on the foundations of this country as we see it now.
Gary Goldsmith, chairperson of the Noongar Nation Aboriginal Corporation. They're speaking to The Wire's Rachel McDonald. There are over 45 million slaves in the world today, and the majority of them are women and children. Essential to stopping this trade in humans is identifying where the demand for their services come from, and Australia is part of the problem. Addressing the demand through outreach, legislation and strategy is Andrea Tokaji. She's the founder and advocate for Fighting for Justice Foundation, and she is taking steps that look at not just preventative and diversionary approaches to stop the demand, but also legislation.
Human trafficking is the greatest human rights violation in the world today, and even though abolitionist slavery over 200 years ago, there are more slaves today than there have ever been before. Australia is a demand nation for slaves and trafficked persons. And if we have consumed tea, coffee, cheap cotton, seafood in our everyday shopping, more likely than not, we've engaged in supporting that slavery in the raw material supply chain. But the majority of slavery in the world today exists not only in brothels around the world, but in brothels in Australia. So, unfortunately, women and children are overrepresented as slaves as well as trafficked persons.
How do you gather data on these different forms of slavery?
There are a number of international reports that has investigated and gathered the data around trafficking. So we know from UNICEF that there are at least 2 million children trafficked and enslaved annually around the world. We know from the Global Slavery Index that there are about 45.8 million known slaves in the world today, and the majority of those are in our region, and the majority are women and girls. We also know from international labour reports that women and girls are overrepresented in every form of trafficking, and of course there are several forms of trafficking. The trafficking occurs through a labour servitude, sexual servitude, through things like forced marriage, even adoptions. And so these are some of the ways that people are trafficked.
When you were talking about people who are in brothels, for example, in Australia, in servitude, how do they get here?
So we know from criminal records and law enforcement reports, court records, that every person who's been trafficked into Australia has entered legally. So that means that they have had visa sponsorship of some kind. We know that the majority of those exploited into sexual servitude in Australia do come either through a student visa or a work visa. I've spoken to some of these victim survivors and also with the organisations that work with them through outreach. A lot of them never see justice. They never are assisted. They are often trapped in their circumstances, really afraid and unwilling to talk. And some of them are repatriated back to their countries without due process.
So they got trapped in the system. They've arrived here for one purpose and then they've slid into this system that has taken advantage of them.
Human trafficking occurs through criminal enterprise and through criminal networks. Everything they do is around deception, fraud, coercion. And unfortunately, they are very well organised. So when a person enters the country under these visa arrangements, unbeknown to themselves, they are immediately put into a sexual slavery situation against their will. Their IDs taken off them, they're obviously raped and abused on a daily basis, and they do not access help for several reasons. There are outreaches that know some of these girls, who they are and where they are, but it's an extremely complex area where the laws don't actually facilitate an easy rehabilitative structure for them and don't really support them in giving evidence to law enforcement. They only have about 45 days to decide whether they want to give evidence in their own trial. And this 45 days is well below the international minimum standard of 6 months, whereby a victim deserves the right to be provided with rehabilitative support in order to make such a decision.
I just wanted to jump in there because I remember spotting last week that there was a minister that had proposed extending the period of support to people who are subject to human trafficking to help them make those decisions. Is that correct?
Even the 100-day time frame is well below the 6 month minimum standard. If someone has been trafficked, held against their will, I mean, such a traumatic incident in life leads to lifelong trauma. And in understanding that, it's obviously a holistic approach that needs to be provided not only for the victim, but as a response to try and prevent these harms from occurring in the first place. So I think it is a wonderful step towards the right direction. But again, it's well below the international minimum standard of 6 months.
Andrea Takagi, founder and advocate of Fighting for Justice Foundation. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Tributes have been flowing in for the late Billy Graham, who passed away overnight at the age of 99. The evangelical pastor was known for his enormous crusades spreading the message of Christianity worldwide. However, will the Protestant Pope leave behind a legacy of good news? Benito Carboni has the story.
Perhaps the only preacher with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, such has been the impact of Billy Graham's death in the United States that flags were lowered to half-mast today, in a show of respect. In today's Australia, his name is much less familiar, though that was not always the case. America's pastor pulled enormous audiences in the 185 countries he visited across the world. The evangelist still holds the record for the most attended event in an Australian stadium, after drawing a crowd in excess of 130,000 to the MCG in a 1959 crusade. Almost 60 years of these crusades saw Billy Graham preach in person to 210 million people. But the pastor did not stop there, having been a spiritual advisor of sorts to each US president since Harry Truman in the early 50s. We contacted Professor Andrew Jutney of Flinders University to further understand the Graham phenomenon.
Billy Graham was the quintessential evangelical. In fact, he somewhat redefined that term, which is now so much a part of the public discourse around Christianity. Some years ago, a range of scholars were trying to come up with a definition of what an evangelical was, and the only definition of evangelical that really seemed to stick was someone who likes Billy Graham. He was that central to the identity.
Just why was he so loved?
He saw a lot of good in American culture, and particularly in mass communication, and he decided to marshal that for the proclamation of the message that he received. He was also a masterful communicator, so he was the first one to use the mass meetings for evangelical purposes, first one to use these enormous choirs and the best of musical composers and performers. He used radio in a way which hadn't been used before, and as television emerged, he used television as well. So he was always right on the cutting edge of the latest developments in mass media and communication.
What was Billy Graham's impact like in Australia when he came around here and did a few crusades?
Billy Graham's impact was immense, just immense, when he toured in 1959. And it was the timing of things as much as anything that made it that way, because really that was about the last point at which he could encounter an Australian society which was broadly biblically literate, because at that stage the Christian church was really the dominant social institution in Australia. Church attendance and membership peaked at the end of the 1950s and has been in steady decline since. And Billy Graham arrived just at that peaking point, and it has to be said he made an enormous impact.
Professor Andrew Jutney there. Despite his southern roots, Billy Graham was on the right side of history when the African American civil rights movement began to gather steam in the 60s. Graham desegregated his rallies in 1953 and was a close friend of Martin Luther King Jr. However, down the track, the pastor's views teetered on the wrong side of history entering the 21st century, particularly in regards to his beliefs on gay rights, which have drawn the ire of critics on social media. Will this tarnish his legacy? Professor Andrew Jutney answers again.
I don't see why it should affect his legacy, because there are heroes of radical Christianity who had very conservative views on a range of things. I mean, people talk about Bonhoeffer a lot, a German pastor and theologian who was martyred in the Second World War, and he's quite rightly celebrated as a champion of justice and civil rights and freedom and peace. But he had some extremely conservative views around matters like homosexuality and suicide and just a range of other things. He was a man of his times, and the same would be said of Billy Graham. There's a very powerful ethical core. Whether or not you agree with him, it's there in his work. Other prominent evangelists and televangelists have made a display of how upright they are. But in Billy Graham's case, I don't think there's ever been any question that what you saw was what you get. It wasn't a facade, it was the man himself. Whereas with some other later televangelists, it was clearly a facade, and people felt rightly let down when it was exposed.
Professor Andrew Dutney speaking with The Wire's Benito Carboni. Bats are a common sight in many states, but microbats are much harder to find. Because of this, researchers struggle to learn about them, how they help us, and what they need. Sylvia Clark is a project officer for Natural Resources Agency for the SA Murray-Darling Basin. She spoke to The Wire's Rachel McDonald about how people power is helping them to learn about these mouse-sized animals.
So we run a number of projects, but our newest, biggest one is the Mega Murray-Darling Microbat Project.
So are microbats a problem or something that you're trying to encourage?
No, generally, they're not a problem. We are trying to encourage them. Every so often, they get in people's roofs. But generally, no, they're a great thing. And often, people don't even know that they're around the place. But quite a few of them are threatened. And most of them, we just don't even know if they're threatened or not. We just really have very little information about them.
So how small is a microbat?
They are really small. They're kind of mouse-sized. Yeah, like a little fluffy mouse, but with wings.
So tell me a little bit about the project. How are people helping you out with this?
So, yeah, we're trying to get as many people as we can involved in the SA Murray-Darling Basin region, because the habitat that they use is in urban areas and rural areas, and so it's in people's backyards. So we really want people to be aware of microbats, know what microbats are around them, and also know what their habitat requirements are. But we need the people to be doing the surveys for us in their backyards for us to get that information, to be able to tell them what to do.
How do you get people involved with this?
We're running a number of bat nights across the region. We'll be doing it this summer and next summer as well, and we did some last summer, so you can come along and learn about microbats. But the main thing we want people to do is borrow anabat recorders, which are little recording devices that they can put up in their backyard on their property overnight, and then they'll record the calls of the bats that go across, because you can't hear the bat calls. There's only one species in our region that you can actually hear, so they're ultrasonic high-frequency sounds that we can't hear. But these detectors pick them up, record them, and then we can have a look at the sonograms, which is the picture file you get from each call, and then we can use that to identify which species are present. So people put these anabats out, and then we get the calls back in, and then we can let them know what species they've got on their property and what kind of habitat they need and how they can actually improve the habitat in their backyard.
Why do people like getting involved with projects like this?
For lots of different reasons, I think. I'm just glad they do. Lots of people just really interested in what's around them, learning new things, being involved in projects that are, you know, creating data that's going to do good things in their local area and for the state. So the data goes, so it's going to be used locally for the reasons I said, but it also goes into the state biological database in South Australia, and it will also go into the Atlas of Living Australia, so it becomes part of the national database. So they're contributing to our research, but also could be all sorts of other research.
Is there anything interesting that you've learned about microbats so far, or does that come later?
It does come later, I'm afraid. We're just getting the data coming in now, but we're picking up some threatened species and some new populations of these threatened species, so it's going to be really exciting.
So what got you into researching microbats?
Oh, I've just always loved bats. I've always kind of loved quirky things. I work with lizards and ants and spiders and now bats. But it is because they're a little known group of animals and they're not very obvious. So it was a nice way to get people aware of these things that they really aren't aware of around them.
Sylvia Clark from Natural Resources SA Murray-Darling Basin speaking to The Wire's Rachel McDonald. That's it for The Wire today. If you'd like to hear our stories again or have your say on our stories, head to our website, thewire.org.au. You can also sign up to podcasts there and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at The Wire Radio. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio Adelaide, and I'm Sarah Martin. Thanks for your company.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.